From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a new online assessment test for Michigan students is coming for spring 2015, but Lansing hasn't yet told districts what tests they'll be giving.
For me, it would be nice as a superintendent, as a principal, to have some concrete answers right now so we can start planning. You know, there's a lot of planning that goes on for next school year that's happening right now.
Plus, Deep Dive Detroit, creating a safe place for uncomfortable and necessary conversations.
I start a lot of the dialogues by saying I'm a racist and it's not entirely my fault.
A closer look at Detroit's new jobs czar.
So Tom Wan has a very large brief, if you will. He's going to be trying to do an awful lot of things. And one of the thoughts that I had as I was talking to him is maybe it's too much.
Plus, how Michigan's failing in access to emergency health care. Those stories and more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for joining us on this Thursday. Today, what do America's emergency room doctors think about the access to ER care that we have here in Michigan? Well, they give our state a failing grade. We'll find out why and what it would take to improve our access to emergency health care. Then we meet a woman trying to help people come together to have some uncomfortable but necessary conversations about race, class, and other issues. But first, out with the MEEP and the MME. Schools around Michigan are gearing up for a new online adaptive assessment test in the spring of 2015. Now, the Michigan Department of Education says the state has only one option for testing students in the Common Core state standards for the next 3 years, and it says that option is the Smarter Balanced Assessment, the SBA. Well, here's the problem for school districts and administrators. Our state lawmakers have not made that official. We wondered how districts are preparing for the SBA or whatever standardized tests the kids will be having to take next year. Joining us is William Heath. He's superintendent of the Morris Area Schools and principal at Morris Junior and Senior High School, located in Shiawassee County. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
So tell us, how will administering Smarter Balance differ from administering the MEEP, which, of course, we know is paper and pencil?
Yeah, so first off, the SBA Smarter Balanced is a computer adaptive test, so it's not just being on a computer. It's also, to simplify it, as a student gets a right answer, they get a harder one. If they get their answer wrong, they get a lower level question, and hopefully it will allow the testing to be able to determine where really is the proficiency. So we're going to have a lot of hurdles in this. When it comes to just giving the test alone, we have to look at our technology and are we ready? And I think the majority across the state, we're all pretty worried about that. And are we going to be ready for the test date when it rolls out? We're used to the MEEP and we're used to the MME and all the hurdles we jump to administer those tests. And if we have those same hurdles with our technology, we're just adding another layer of potential problems.
So technology-wise, what do you need for Smarter Balanced? I guess it would start with enough devices for your kids.
That's correct. So with the MEEP and the MME, we would have one day to take that test.
Yes.
From my understanding, originally they were talking about a 12-week window that we would run. I've heard rumors that it's down to a 4-week window. I'm not sure on that. As that window gets smaller of how much time we have to test, the harder it's going to be. So ideally, if you, in a perfect world, you'd have one desktop computer for every kid. And I say desktop intentionally because my understanding of schools that have done some of the pilots for the Smarter Balanced have said that the bigger the computer screen, the easier it is for kids to read the test and to manage through the test.
Okay.
And so a lot of school districts have jumped to a one-to-one device, which is great for kids, but plan on using those to assess kids. And that's going to be difficult on an iPad or whatever handheld device they have.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, I think when we get through this, we're going to realize that either a laptop or a desktop model is probably going to be the best, a larger screen. Some of these tests have split screens, so you'll read something on the left and on the right, and you can scroll on either side. The more that you put into a test, the harder it is to do with an iPad. So, you know, it'd be great to have a computer for every kid. We don't have that here. That's, you know, space-wise, that would take up a lot of room. One-to-one devices would work. We have a bring-your-own-device policy, so a lot of students are bringing in their own devices and using those on our internet. But if they give us a large enough window, we should be fine. That way we can bring kids through and kind of cycle them through. You know, I've got two computer labs at our high school, 30-some-odd computers, about 35 computers in each lab. So I can test about 70 kids at any given time. But if I had to test the whole school at the same time, that wouldn't work.
I also saw in one report that the recommended bandwidth specifications, it's 50 kilobits, and there's only 62% of Michigan schools that have that bandwidth. So
yeah.
Is that causing some concern at Morris schools?
It is. It's not as big of a concern for me. Shiawassee County has done pretty good in helping us out with all of that. I know there is a concern at our RSD level is if all the schools are testing at the same time, how's that going to work? Because they kind of manage our system for us.
Yeah.
You know, is it going to work? You know, is a kid going to be taking a test and all of a sudden it's going to crash on them? The pilots have, from my understanding, have run well, but they haven't had, you know, every school within a county testing at the same time. And we run into problems, you know, on occasion when we have high volume days anyways, when depending on what teachers are doing in their classrooms. So it could be an issue. I think anything could be an issue. That's my biggest concern as we do this is that it's spring of 2014. Well, if you don't look outside.
Yeah, we won't look outside, but I know what you're saying. For planning purposes, yes.
It's spring of, and we're talking about doing this testing next year at the exact same time, and there's too many unknowns. Mm-hmm. You mentioned before in your intro mm-hmm. that, you know, we're using the Smarter Balanced, and sure, I haven't been told specifically that we are, and I think if we get into the politicians with this, I don't think they agree to that. And so will it be something other than Smarter Balanced? And so, if it is, is that test ready to go?
So here you have this report from the Michigan Department of Education going, well, yep, it looks like the one option is Smarter Balanced. But as you say, no one has made that crystal clear to you yet.
No, not at all. And if you talk to your local politician, they probably, some of them will disagree and say that, well, maybe we need to go to the ACT has another one that's kind of in the running, I guess you could say. For me, it would be nice as a superintendent, as a principal, to have some concrete answers right now so we can start planning. We're writing student schedules for next year. We're planning, you know, there's a lot of planning that goes on for next school year that's happening right now, and I need to know how long is my window going to be, what's my test going to be like, so that I can help prepare the kids, but also prepare my staff and my building to get ready for this test.
And when you express those concerns, to whom are you expressing them, and what kind of response do you get?
Well, sometimes now you're walking me in a corner here. Obviously, area superintendents and principals, we all have this discussion, and our counselors, and trying to figure this out. Some of our superintendents are probably a little more vocal with their local politicians and state politicians. And I don't know, you know, when you get involved in the politics side of schools, it gets ugly.
Yeah.
I think politics, no matter what side you're on, has a tendency to get ugly sometimes, and there's people being pulled in a lot of different directions. I think if we all try to use the filter of what's best for kids, we probably could get on the same page and get a decent result in this. I'm not opposed to moving to a computer adaptive testing. Mm-hmm. I'm not opposed to assessing on the Common Core state standards at all. My concern is that these results are tied to some important things, including funding and how we run our schools. And we're used to using the MEEP and we're used to using the MME. Well, next year we move to something different. And those test scores are going to be compared to our previous year's test scores. And it's probably not going to look too bright for the whole state of Michigan after these new round of test scores come through. And when they keep adding, there's another layer, now we're computers, now it's a different style test, it's off a different curriculum standards, and so now there's all these variables. I was a science teacher
mm-hmm.
before I did all this. This is a bad experiment. This experimental design is not working for me on my science mindset. We probably should take one thing at a time, but it seems like we're jumping in 2 feet, and we're gonna do this test in the spring and kind of hope we're ready. Unfortunately, I think that the people that will pay for this will end up being our kids.
William Heath, superintendent of Morris Area Schools and also principal of Morris Junior and Senior High School there in Shiawassee County. Mr. Heath, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you.
Want to know more about the future of testing in Michigan? Stateside, along with our friends over at State of Opportunity, have been covering all the debate happening now in Lansing. Be sure to check out our website, michiganradio.org, for the latest on Smarter Balanced, Common Core, and other education issues that impact our kids here in Michigan. So this is worth noting as Facebook marks its 10th birthday. Social media has become a powerful tool for the Michigan Humane Society as it seeks homes for its orphaned animals. Kelly Stork is a social media specialist for the Michigan Humane Society. Now, we know for years members of the Humane Society team have been on TV newscasts or radio shows bringing adoptable, adorable pets. But this takes us to a new level, right?
Oh, yes, it does. It's more real time. So you post an animal and the same like minute someone can view that animal and learn all about his background history, how old he is, where he's available for adoption, and come right into our shelter and adopt that pet.
How do you best sell an animal's assets or a character of an animal to the public using Facebook and other social media?
Well, the key is to have a really cute picture, and you can't go wrong with our adoptable animals, or a really cute video. And really, it's just getting into their background story, how they came to the shelter, and, you know, what kind of characteristics and personality that animal has. And people really can connect that way with that animal when they see all the background story on them in their photo.
And speaking of that, have you been able to track up any provable increase in adoptions since really turning to social media this way?
It's hard to come up with concrete numbers, but we know we've seen an increase in adoptions just because from the animals we post, people on Facebook saying that they came in to adopt that particular animal and then posting the picture of themselves with that animal in their new forever home. So it's really neat to see.
Kelly Stork, social media specialist for the Michigan Humane Society. Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Time now for our weekly check-in with Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. His focus today is on someone who says he's got the best job in America. Tom LaWand is the man in the Mike Duggan administration whose mission is to find jobs for Detroiters. And Daniel, some might argue Tom LaWand has the worst job in America.
Yeah, and I might be one of them. it's a challenge. There's no question about it. Officially, his title is Group Executive for Jobs in the Economy, which is a big mouthful. But he is taking on an awful lot. And I asked him, "What do you need to do? How are we going to judge you?" And he says, "Judge me by creating jobs for Detroiters." So we got into this long conversation about what does that mean, and looking at the kind of work and jobs that are coming into the city right now. A lot of them are disproportionately high-tech, a lot of college-degree-type jobs. And as we know, Detroit has got a population that is varying degrees of illiteracy, and some people raise the question about how much of them are, in fact, employable. So the question is, how do you bridge that chasm?
Yeah.
One of the things that he's talking about is worker training, and I describe it in the column as kind of an all-of-the-above approach, and that's what he says he's going to be focusing on, but I think we have to see. He talks with the enthusiasm of a guy who's in a new job, probably doesn't really know what he's fully got himself into. He's been practicing law for many, many years at Bodman, and one of his clients was Bill Ford Jr., the executive chairman of Ford Motor Company. So it's a real change of pace for Tom.
Tell us some more about who Tom LaWand is, besides the fact that he's the father of the Detroit Lions president. We want to make that clear, that Tom LaWand Jr. runs the Lions.
Correct. And Tom Sr., as he's often referred to, is, I think he's 67 years old. He's practiced law for many years, a very well-connected Democrat, managed some campaigns. Carl Levin, I think his original campaign when he ran for Senate back in the late 1970s. He worked in the Blanchard administration. He's been on the periphery of the Granholm years from time to time. So very well-connected into the state Democratic network.
Also, and what's his importance with Mike Duggan? Where is his importance in the Duggan circle of advisors?
I'd say he's key, very key. I think one of the things that Mayor Mike Duggan clearly prizes in the people around him is a sense of loyalty and people that he has known and trusts. And I think Tom LaWand is one of those people, and clearly he's put him in a very high-profile job. Because the other piece of this, which is very important, is the whole economic development efforts, trying to do development deals, work with the Detroit Economic Growth Corporation, which for the last three mayors has really been the locus of economic development in the city of Detroit. The longtime head there is now resigning and moving on, in part because I think the Tom Lawan coming into this job was going to, for the first time, put up somebody between the president of the DEGC and the mayor. And that was not something that this that George Jackson was prepared to do.
Okay.
So Tom Lawan has a very large brief, if you will. He's going to be trying to do an awful lot of things. And one of the thoughts that I had as I was talking to him is maybe it's too much, that he's trying to do too many things all at the same time. But I think he and I agreed as we talked about it, this is a potentially a great opportunity. I mean, Detroit is, I think, poised for a fundamental turnaround. We've been talking about that a lot, you and I, over the last months. And I think he sees that. He's got a lot of interest from investors all over the country and even, indeed all over the world who look at a place like Detroit and think there's a lot of upside there.
Well, as you point out in your column in the Detroit News, Daniel, the track record with Detroit City Hall and capital markets is not something that might engender confidence if you have capital to invest. Do you think he can convince the would-be investors it's a new day in Detroit?
Well, I think he can certainly get him to listen, because I think if you look at a lot of the different elements of what's going on in Detroit, that could be a persuasive case. You've got different leadership. You've got an emergency manager who is unwinding some of these financial relationships in bankruptcy court. You've got a state government that is more engaged probably in the city of Detroit in issues that can help support the city of Detroit and a turnaround in Detroit than we've seen in anybody's memory. So there are a lot of things, and you've got a business community that is A, very engaged, B, enthusiastic, and C, making money. And
people like the Dan Gilberts of the world?
And the auto companies. Auto suppliers. And, you know, you've got cultural organizations that, you know, the DSO, the DIA, the MOT that have gotten their own houses in order. So you can look at a lot of the different sectors of what comprises that big kind of business philanthropic community. And you got a lot of green arrows there, to borrow an auto phrase, and that, I think that also is a positive. So I think he's got a lot of things on his side, but he also has the realities of Detroit that he has to contend with, and the reputation that it's getting in the capital markets for having done these financial deals and then not paying on them.
When you sat down and talked with Tom Lawan, and you noted he uses that pronoun "we," who is "we"? Did he really spell that out?
I think "we" is the administration. I think this is a much more of a team. There's a much more of a team-based approach that Mike Duggan is trying to put together here. I've seen this in the auto industry too. More recently, I've heard a lot from General Motors. Under Dan Akerson and now under Mary Barra, you've certainly seen it under Al Mulally since going back to 2006 at Ford. You see it to some extent with Chrysler that this is a team thing. This is not about one person or about the leader or the CEO. It's about a group of people that all have a role to play. They're expected to play that role. And one of the things that the CEO is doing is holding them accountable to execute that role. But it's a we, and I think that's the way he approaches it. As it happens, there's a story in the Detroit News this morning about the mayor and his style. I mean, this is a guy who, after his inauguration on the 1st, after he's sworn into office, goes, puts on blue jeans and hops in a snowplow and rides around with one of the drivers while he's plowing the streets. This is a guy who, Tom Lawan told me, got in his car. The mayor of the city of Detroit drove to Louisville, Kentucky to recruit the person that he wanted to be the next chief information officer of the city of Detroit. He personally drove down, and I can tell you that the people that have had that job in recent years would not have done that.
Interesting to watch the development and the work of Detroit's job czar, Tom Lawan. Always good to talk with you, Detroit News business columnist Daniel House. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
A new face recently joined the cast of Saturday Night Live and made a lot of headlines when she did.
It's Saturday Night Live with Sasheer Zamata.
Comic Sasheer Zamata became the first black female cast member of SNL in 5 years since the departure of Maya Rudolph. She was discovered through a talent search that focused strictly on black female comics. And we wondered, what does this other extra attention mean for other black women who want to make us laugh? Well, one of those women is Detroiter Satori Shakur, actor, writer, comedian, and creator of the Secret Society of Twisted Storytellers. Welcome to the program, Satori.
Thank you very much. Thank you for asking me to be part. I'm happy to come and talk about Sashir Zamata is I'm burning to talk about it.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, what did you think, Satori, about all that attention paid, not just to Sashir joining SNL, but all the focus on the showcases for black comedians, the casting, and the criticism that SNL's cast was missing some diversity?
Well, it's a perfect example of our 21st century social media and how the world gets to weigh in on certain things. And when that issue came up and it was broadcast to, and I got a taste of it, it was like, yeah, well, what's up with that SNL? Well, why? And not only SNL, but the world. Where are the African American funny women? Because we are here, and we have hung on. Now, inside the context of Saturday Night Live and who that program appeals to, what the demographic is, but I'm just hoping that the comedy will sort of broaden and expand the different kinds of African American people and ideas and that there are comedically that it span, that we don't get stuck with the different kinds of stereotypical things that are just surface and not get to really what I believe comedy really is about, which is humanity and all of the ways that we can lift it up by examining how funny we are when life is introduced to us and we're knocked down or brought up or what are all the things that happen to us, how we deal with life.
You know, Satori, when we think of comedians, I get the sense, tell me if I'm wrong here, I think there's a fair amount of diversity among the ranks of the men. I mean, you've got your Robin Williams and Jerry Seinfeld and Louis C.K., but you've got Chris Rock and Sinbad and George Lopez and Carlos Mencia. You think
Russell
of women.
Simmons.
Yeah. But when I think of women, I think of there's Tina Fey, there's Amy Poehler, and the late Gilda Radner. So it really does feel like black female comedians are indeed underrepresented on the stages in America and the comedy clubs of America.
Yes, I would love to see on Saturday Night Live the Black View or something. Four women at the table, and they're all different kinds of black women, and they all have different views. Like, you know, Cheryl Underwood, who I think is the funniest woman in the world, she made a comment about hair. You know, who wants nappy? You know, so it would be great to see the black view and have, you know, a big afro, some locks, a very weaved woman, and Cheryl. And all the women are talking about her remark, you know, and discussing it, you know, or something. I mean, once you get into African-American issues and stories and circumstances, it's going to inevitably touch on other cultures, white cultures, because we're all connected. So comedy, I think the greatest comedy is rooted in those real life situations and the funny thing, it sheds light on the human condition. It connects us as human beings, and we aren't left with stereotypes.
What would you tell the next generation of female comics?
What I would tell the next generation of female comedians, but specifically black comedians, female comedians, is to continue to tell your stories. Don't conform. Just be human, you know, because they're looking for voices, original voices, and those come from taking the risk of being who you are and exploring and putting those things out there, you know. So it's not about the jokes. It's about the voice.
Detroit comic Satori Shakur, who is not only a comic, a writer, an actor, and she is the creator of the Secret Society of Twisted Storytellers. And you can find out more about her work at her website, satorishakur.com. It's been fun talking to you, Satori. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
So what is the price we pay when we don't open up and talk about hot-button issues, racism, poverty, food justice, LGBT rights, and so much more? That's what my next guest asked herself, which led her to co-found Deep Dive Detroit. Its mission is to create a safe place for uncomfortable conversations between disparate groups. Co-founder Lauren Hood, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks, Cynthia.
So what does Deep Dive Detroit do to help open up the floor to these uncomfortable conversations?
Well, the programming consists of immersion experiences. So we've got a day-long, a weekend-long, or a week-long immersion into a particular social justice issue. But I think what makes this kind of programming different from others is it's close quarters. So we do groups no bigger than 10. And all of the quote-unquote experts kind of experience it with you. They're not at a podium. They're not at a table in front of the group. They're a part of the group. So everyone's seated in a circle, and you've got, like, face-to-face contact with the people that are experts in the issue that we're addressing. And the expert isn't necessarily a professional person that would normally be contacted to do something like this. It's just an average citizen that's affected with the justice issue.
So what happens? Let's say, give me a typical kind of issue that's going to be the subject of an immersion.
Well, the last one we did was returning citizens and restorative justice. So usually the immersions are equal parts presentations. I think the most gripping part of the immersion experience is the storytelling. So like I said, we have the average person, but somebody who's a particular expert on a justice issue. So at the last one, a friend of mine who is a returning citizen, who is also, he's now getting a PhD in public policy at Jackson State. But given all the progress that he's made in the last few years, he's got a criminal record for something he did in 1997. So he can't find a job. He can't find a place to live. So just listening to him tell his story was, I think, the most powerful piece in the immersion experience.
It strikes me that when you think of the medical procedure of lancing a boil, there's something that's festering underneath. It's causing pain, discomfort. And the process of lancing that boil is not pretty. It's not fun. But then you get through it.
Right.
And you get it out. And there's healing. Is that kind of like what's happening in Detroit?
Oh, for sure. What I think about every time I walk into an immersion, I'm like, if I haven't made you uncomfortable, then we're not doing our job. If everyone's sitting around with smiles on their faces and no one looks nervous and no one's fidgeting, then we're not getting at the issue. The point of it is to make people uncomfortable, to where they need to be comfortable in the space they were in, but be uncomfortable with the issue we're talking about. And, like, we want to walk people through that discomfort.
I'm speaking with Lauren Hood, who is a co-founder of Deep Dive Detroit. Its mission to create a safe place for uncomfortable conversations between disparate groups. What kinds of topics do you want to explore in these immersions?
Well, I think what's a hot-button issue in Detroit right now would be the issue of gentrification. That in and of itself is such a huge issue. There's so many levels to gentrification. So there has to do with privilege and racism and poverty. And there's so many levels to that. So I think that we want to address things that are affecting Metro Detroiters right now, and that seems to be a huge issue that I hear both sides of it. So I'm a member of a privileged group, and then I have a certain education and I work in a certain field, but I'm also a member of a disparate group because I'm a minority and I'm a woman and I grew up on the northwest side of the city. So I hear both sides of the argument all the time, and I think that's an issue where a bridge needs to be built.
How do you think we need or we should be building sustainable relationships between different groups of people?
It starts with being honest and being to call yourself out on your own crap. So I start a lot of the dialogues by saying I'm a racist and it's not entirely my fault. I mean, if you've ever turned on a television or read a newspaper, these messages are coming at you like nonstop since birth. So by calling myself out on my own stuff.
What messages are coming at you?
I mean, well, when you turn on the news and what does the criminal look like? Every time they're saying somebody was shot, what does the shooter look like? You're watching Law and Order. What do the criminals always look like on those shows? Just typically the things that you see, what does the criminal look like and what does the victim look like? Those things I think are always at play in our subconscious. And I don't think it's entirely our fault that we hold on to some racist and prejudicial tendencies.
And so through facilitating these immersions, you're hoping to kind of get that going, lance that boil. And
exactly. Just so we could stop looking at people that didn't have our same experiences as different. We're all just the same. You just had a different set of experiences.
Who brings you on board? Does a group invite you in? Do you say, here we are, we're going to have an immersion, a company? How does it work?
Well, it's interesting. So initially when we started it, we thought about just asking the general public, like whoever wants to come can sign up and come. But since I put the word out that I was doing this, people have been coming to me. So other organizations want to partner, other individuals who are interested in doing similar work want to partner. So it's really just I'm listening to the call of the universe, if that doesn't sound too hippie.
and hoping, again, as you say, to force these uncomfortable moments for the healing that can happen afterwards.
Exactly.
Lauren Hood, co-founder of Deep Dive Detroit. You can visit her website. It's deepdivedetroit.com, deepdivedetroit.com. Lauren, thanks for coming in and talking with us today.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Still to come, Michigan is failing in access to emergency care, at least according to a new report card from America's Emergency Room Physicians. Coming up next, we ask why. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. How are we doing as a state when it comes to our emergency rooms and access to emergency health care? According to a report card recently released by the American College of Emergency Physicians, the answer is not very well. Michigan got an overall grade of D, 46th in the nation, and it's an emergency care environment. And we got an F, a failing grade in access to emergency care. Just why are we failing in access to this life or death care in our state? We're joined now by Dr. Michael Noss. He's a senior emergency room physician at Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit, and he's a board member of the Michigan College of Emergency Physicians. Dr. Noss, good to have you on Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Well, the report card tells us that Michigan showed improvement in some areas, quality and patient safety, but we're really failing in access to emergency care. Just what does that mean?
Well, first and foremost, we want to make sure people understand that this report card has to do with the conditions under which emergency care is delivered, not the quality of the care that is given in every hospital in the state of Michigan. The specific issues with access to care have to do not only with access to primary care, but also access to specialty care. We are lucky in the state of Michigan that emergency medicine is an old specialty here. There's many training programs. Therefore, there are many hospitals that deliver quality emergency care. However, sometimes when you go to a hospital, the emergency medicine physician can stabilize you, but you may need access to a specialty physician such as ear, nose, and throat, orthopedic surgery, trauma surgery, hand surgery, and that's where Michigan is lacking. Our numbers and our availability to have these specialties on call and have them come in and see patients to the emergency room is lacking and is much less common and less available than other states.
And why is that?
Part of it is just keeping those specialties in the state of Michigan. Our medical malpractice climate is not as good as some states, especially related to emergency care and EMTALA-related care. EMTALA is the national statute that governs emergency care and deems that everyone who comes to the ER is provided a medical screening exam. Okay. But certainly some specialty physicians are concerned that the patients that they will see in the emergency room will typically have very complex injuries or complex conditions. They have no pre-association with the patient. They don't know their history. The surgery or the treatment they give may be more complex, such as a dirty wound from a firecracker injury is kind of the classic example.
Sure.
And so they're a bit hesitant to take call because of that.
And what other problems do we see with access to emergency care? So we've established that there are a good number of emergency room physicians, but we're lacking in those specialists that are needed for a lot of these injuries.
That is correct. Yeah. There's also issues with the number of staffed hospital beds. And so Michigan is below average in the number of hospital beds per 100,000 people in the state when you look at geographically around. Also, our number of psychiatric inpatient beds is very low. It's not uncommon to have patients in the emergency room for 24 or even 36 hours waiting for an inpatient psychiatric bed to come open somewhere in the Metro Detroit area. Patients are being transferred somewhat far distances to try to get that inpatient spot.
And this is really something that has been a factor since the 90s when Lafayette Clinic and Northville Hospital and other facilities were shut down.
Correct. There's been a big move to try to manage as much of this as possible as an outpatient. Mm-hmm. However, there are a lot of patients whose psychiatric disease is so severe that outpatient just doesn't work for them. They end up bouncing back to emergency rooms and kind of failing the outpatient treatment. Therefore, they need to go inpatient. And as you said, we've closed several large inpatient facilities in the state of Michigan over the last few decades.
What about Medicaid fee levels for office visits? Is that a factor in this problem with access to emergency care?
Yes. I know that certainly with the Obamacare going into effect in the near future, some of it has gone into effect now. This is going to be interesting to see how things go. We're getting some reports from the state of Oregon, who expanded their Medicaid a few years ago, that ER rates for the newly insured did go up. There's some conflicting reports out of the state of Massachusetts. When they expanded their Medicaid back about 10 years ago, some reports initially said the volume went up, some said it went down. Mm-hmm. And so certainly we are concerned that having a lower than average Medicaid reimbursement is going to disincentivize primary care physicians from seeing these newly insured patients. I know the governor recently released a survey that stated, I believe, in the upper 80% of primary care physicians in the state of Michigan stated they would take new Medicaid patients. That is certainly a good thing. We as emergency physicians are excited to have patients who have more coverage. Mm-hmm. We want to make sure that people understand, however, that having insurance doesn't equal access. There's several issues. There's access to emergency care, which is having the correct specialist on board when need be, mm-hmm. but there's also access to care in general. Just because you have insurance doesn't mean a primary care physician is going to have an opening or a subspecialty physician is going to have an appointment for you within the time period that you feel is appropriate.
So somebody could call, you know, having, let's say, received insurance coverage now. So healthcare coverage, we've expanded the Medicaid roles. So they've got insurance coverage, but they might not get an appointment for 2-3 months.
Correct.
So they wind up in your emergency room.
Correct. And obviously for us, you know, there is a lot of press out there about the concern of these patients and the cost of these patients coming to the emergency room. Mm-hmm. For us, it's not really a cost issue. Certainly, overall, that's a fact that plays a role. But you have to understand, we're already open. A physician is already paid to be there. Nurses are already paid to be there. It's just about getting the patient to the right place. Certainly, seeing a primary care physician on a regular basis who knows you and who knows how you look when you're well and who knows how you look when you're ill is advantageous in general. Also, to have a emergency physician see a patient with a minor care complaint, be it a sore throat, a cough, a bump, or a bruise, those are usually quick and easy. It's those patients who have more complex chronic medical conditions that we're really hoping will get primary care rapidly and regularly. So those patients with high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol, things that could lead toward heart attacks, strokes, mm-hmm. and things down the line.
So what needs to happen in the view of the American College of Emergency Physicians? So we have this grade of D in access to emergency care. What could fix that in the view of emergency physicians?
Certainly upping the Medicaid fee for office visits would be helpful. Obviously, with the ACA, they're going to increase the Medicaid reimbursement over the next several years to reimburse at Medicare levels. Mm-hmm. That is certainly very advantageous. And I know that a lot of primary care groups, as the governor's questionnaire did say, they are going to accept these Medicaid patients. I know a lot of primary care groups are doing their best to have Saturday hours and late hours and things like that to try to avoid ER visits if need be. But other things that could be done is strengthening our medical malpractice climate. The Michigan chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians have sponsored a couple bills over the last 2 years, one in the state Senate, one in the state House. It'll have to be reintroduced this year, basically looking to change the statute for malpractice for EMTALA-related care. From negligence to gross negligence, this is in line with Texas and what Georgia has done. This is in line with pre-hospital providers, EMS, because obviously the information that we as emergency physicians and EMS get from a patient is very limited. It's not uncommon, unfortunately, that we will have a patient who presents in cardiac arrest who obviously cannot speak for themselves, and we don't know anything about them, including their name at times.
So there can be things done legislatively?
Yes. I think, you know, this is a multi-pronged approach. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's the malpractice climate, which is a legislative issue. There is the Medicaid reimbursement rates, which is kind of a state issue. You know, so there's a lot of different things that can be done.
Also, I noted that Michigan got a grade of D+ in the area of public health and injury prevention. And one might conclude the higher the grade in this area, the fewer people will wind up in your emergency room needing care. What are the factors that contributed? Seems to be lifestyle things that contributed to this poor grade.
Correct. This is also multifactorial. Unfortunately, over the last several years, our overall adult flu vaccine rate has dropped from 70-some percent down to almost 50%. Mm-hmm. You know, just within the last month, I admitted two patients to the hospital who were influenza positive. Both were dialysis patients. So these are people who are touched by the medical system on a regular basis, and somehow they did not get an influenza vaccine. That may or may not have prevented their disease, but it's just if any population is going to benefit from full vaccination, it would be, you know, the elderly and those with chronic medical conditions. And so certainly flu vaccine, pneumonia vaccine for patients over 65. Michigan, unfortunately, also has a high smoking rate and obesity rate that contributed to this. And then also our change in the helmet law. Certainly that's received a lot of press over the last several years. And there's some studies coming out now that the deaths have increased slightly and the serious injuries have increased slightly as well.
Dr. Michael Noss, emergency physician at Henry Ford Hospital. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Think about World War II and the ways Michigan helped that war effort. The arsenal of democracy, Rosie the Riveter, heavy bombers rolling off that assembly line at Willow Run, and milkweed. Yeah, the common weed found in the Northwest Lower Peninsula went to war. Joining us to explain why and how is historian and freelance author-illustrator Jerry Weix. He recently wrote about this for MLive and Michigan History Magazine. Hello, Jerry.
Yes, how are you doing, Cindy?
Good. Well, farmers hate this stuff, right? How did it come to be so useful in the war effort in World War II?
Yeah, it's kind of an amazing turnaround story. The fact that up to that time, you know, milkweed was the enemy here on shore. But obviously with the needs to, tackle another enemy during World War II, milkweed came to the fore simply because it became the only really suitable replacement as fillers for life vests and life preservers. And in short, our stock of Kapok, which was used to stuff the life preservers pre-war, our supply became cut off by the Japanese. And after that, there was pretty well a scramble to try to figure out what else could be used to perform this very strategic function.
So who looked at this weed that farmers just hate and said, hey, this stuff was going to take the place of Kapok?
Well, it's an interesting story because the fact that the idea of using milkweed for many other purposes actually had been around for a very long time. But to get to the point of our story, it was a fellow by the name of Boris Berkman, who was a Russian immigrant who moved to Chicago. He was a practicing physician in Chicago who had an interest in research, and it was his idea starting in the mid to late 30s to try to develop this resource known as milkweed. And he had already was in the process of patenting a machine, a milkweed gin, as it was called, in order to separate the floss, which is the parachute, if you were, that's attached to the little seeds in milkweed, to separate it from the seeds. And he already had this idea going. Of course, his idea for milkweed was far greater than just the floss, but because he had already been developing that, when this situation and shortage occurred, it was his proposal that he brought before the U.S. government, and they jumped on it and said, this looks like a good replacement. So he had this idea before this happened, and it was fortuitous, I guess, if you want to look at it that way, that he had the mechanism ready to go, or the thought process already ready to go by the time the war occurred.
And then lucky for Petoskey and the counties that surround it tended to have the most concentration of wild milkweed in the country.
Yeah, which is something you think of, you know, it's probably not something the best thing you'd want to be known as the center of a weed. As it turns out, yes, they did some research. The scientists from the USDA and other places did research as to where the highest concentration of milkweed was. Now, there's some 20 different species of milkweed, but they're looking for the one called the common milkweed, which is the one most of your listeners would be familiar with. And they found out that it was in the northwest part of the lower peninsula of Michigan, especially centered on Emmett County and Petoskey, that had the highest concentration of milkweed in the country. And this had to do basically with the area being lumbered over and the soil was a bit worn out, and milkweed, being a very pernicious weed, took over and dominated that landscape. So that was the place to go if you wanted to set up any kind of a business dealing with milkweed. And the funny part is that it was the people of Petoskey who eventually embraced this. I mean, they became very proud not only of this new industry, but also the fact that they were the center of the milkweed population in the country. I mean, they really, really embraced it. It was pretty incredible.
Well, it was the time when really the home front wanted to do its bit for the war, whether it was Victory Gardens or dealing with the you know, ration coupons. So I love the slogan that you included in your story for MLive: two bags save one life. So they really felt they were making a difference to our Marines and soldiers and sailors.
Exactly. And this is where this story really becomes interesting, because the only way that this milkweed floss could be collected was to hand collect the pods off of the milkweeds that are in the field. And because of all the other industries that were going on and the adults either at war or performing other function, it became kind of the onus of the school children of the country, Michigan especially, but also of the whole northeastern United States and even a couple provinces in Quebec, to go out there and collect these pods. It was a simple job, but it was something that had to be done, and it was the school children of America that were enlisted to do this. One of the pamphlets that was sent out to the schools at the time, you know, with that same phrase, the two bags save one life, you know, it had the, in very bold print at the bottom, it says, "School children of America, help save your father's, brother's, and neighbor's lives by collecting milkweed pods." So it became, you know, very much a patriotic drive and something that anybody could do. And as a matter of fact, little hands probably were better for picking the pods. And then they would pick them, put them into onion bags, or the open mesh onion bags, mm-hmm. and then they would be collected for drying. So that's a very special part of this particular function, that it depended upon school children of Michigan and of America.
It's something to think, though, Jerry, when we look at those pictures from World War II of our Marines and sailors and soldiers on those troop carriers wearing their May West, that they probably were stuffed with Michigan milkweed.
Exactly. Such a humble beginning of a weed, and I guess that just goes to show you that, you know, this country proved itself so many times in crisis that it was able to look at such a common product, you know, as a weed, and then actually bring it to war and make it help out, you know, for the war effort. Pretty remarkable stuff.
And historian and author-illustrator Jerry Weix wrote about Michigan's milkweed in World War II for MLive and Michigan History Magazine. And we would love to hear from you as we wind up our week. What stories are grabbing your attention? What issues do you want to hear more about? Let us know. You can find us on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. Of course, we're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And always find us on the website, michiganradio.org, and click on the link that says Stateside. Our program today was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Engineer today was Bob Scon. Contributors to Stateside are Mercedes Mejia, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Hattlesley, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisketter, and Jeff Werniak. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening, and let's talk Monday afternoon at 3 o'clock.